This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering, and it's Friday, which means it is time for our Week in Review. Masks and gloves both came off this week. President Biden rolled back most of the outdoor mask mandate for the vaccinated on Tuesday.
Starting today, if you're fully vaccinated and you're outdoors, you need, and not in a big crowd, you no longer need to wear a mask.
Charlie Baker waited until today to allow us to be maskless outdoors, but he included everybody.
The light at the end of the tunnel, thanks to the hard work of so many, is getting closer, and we can start to look ahead with real optimism for the path forward.
Acting Boston Mayor Kim Janey said Boston will slow its roll on some other parts of reopening.
We have vulnerable populations here. As we continue to get folks vaccinated, we hope to continue to see the data trending in the right direction, and we will continue to loosen restrictions.
Meanwhile, the gloves are off in Washington.
Behind President Biden's familiar face, it's like the most radical Washington Democrats have been handed the keys, and they're trying to speed as far left as they can possibly go before American voters ask for the car back.
On a progressive agenda tailor fit to the priorities of Massachusetts's progressive delegation. So let's talk about all of it, and we will start with the reopening, especially masks off outdoors. If you're vaccinated, according to the CDC, not necessary if it's here in the Commonwealth. Are you going without a mask today? Were you already? And if you're not going to, why not? Also, what else should we be lifting? 800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining us now, our Week in Review panelists this week, Michael Curry, President and CEO of the Massachusetts League of Community Health Centers, also a member of the National NAACP's Board of Directors, and Jennifer Braceras, political analyst, lawyer, and director of the Independent Women's Law Center. Michael, Jennifer, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Glad to be here.
Great to have you both. So I'm just going to ask you first, has either of you been outside without a mask yet? Michael, have you?
To some degree. I think I'm still in the practice of wearing a mask most places, so it'll be a hard thing to break. I think just modeling wearing a mask is a good thing. So I try to do it just so that we know that we're not fully past this pandemic. So it'll come off eventually since I've received my 2 shots.
And Jennifer, how about you? Have you been out without a mask yet?
I do not wear a mask outside. I never have. It's not scientifically necessary. It is virtually impossible for somebody walking by or running by somebody without a mask to catch COVID. And so I have not adopted that practice, and I'm glad to see it lifted.
All right, so let's talk about the tension the two of you just raised between signaling and the science. And I will say on the question of not scientifically necessary, it's interesting. I don't remember if it was last week or the week before, but we had Dr. Ashish Jha on the show from Brown University. And I had a conversation with him about our evolving understanding around masks, other things, and what that does as we change what we think the science tells us. And I want to note that because Dr. Jha was not firmly in or out of your camp, Jennifer, from the beginning, but certainly did advocate at this point that in most situations, it's time to lift the mask mandate. How do you, Michael, think?
A little more clear. I mean, the science indicates that it is extremely unlikely that somebody would transmit or catch it that way. The science can't tell us whether or not it's necessary to wear a mask. That's a risk calculation. So I misspoke a little bit, but very unlikely to catch it that way. And therefore, in my view, unnecessary to wear a mask out of doors when you're you know, more than 6 feet away from people. I'm not talking about going.
Right. No, and I appreciate that. And so let's stay with those two pieces. Michael, I'm going to come to you about signaling. And then Jennifer, I'm going to come back to you about risk calculation, because I think you both have raised really important pieces of the conversation that don't always get drawn to the top. So Michael, you basically said, I'm trying to signal some seriousness to other people by wearing that mask. Talk a little bit more about that. And tell me, I think, Michael, do others signal to you that way, you know, when you see their behavior?
Yeah, so I think it's important. For the last year, I've lived the science. You know, I represent 52 health centers across the state. We have over 1 million patients, and I've had to live and breathe what the science is telling us. And I listen to the Faucis, to all the local epidemiologists and doctors who do this work. I would say, you know, there's nuance to this. When I go jogging, I don't wear a mask because I'm distanced from people, to Jennifer's point. But then there are also outdoor circumstances where you're in, congested settings, if I say, and people are closely together. It could be in your backyard, and you can contract the disease that way. So I think, you know, we sort of split hairs talking about whether you can wear one outside or not. But the reality is, it's about the circumstances you're in, and you could contract the disease standing outside.
We're actually probably not that far apart, because when I talk about going outside without a mask, I'm talking about walking my dog, going for a run, you know, being outside in my yard with family members. I don't live in a city. I live in a suburb that's not that densely populated. So in some ways, Michael and I are probably much closer together than it may have first seemed.
And me, yeah, and Jennifer tend ahead, to Michael. Be close together at times. So I appreciate Jennifer pointing that out.
Well, and again, I find, and I want to be really clear about this, I find real value in drawing out the idea of how our behavior signals things to other people, and also the reality of the fact that we need to and do make risk calculations all the time, and we can't strip this conversation of risk calculus either. So, Jennifer, talk a little bit more about that risk calculus piece of this equation.
Well, sure. I mean, you know, the example you hear people talk about all the time is getting into a car or getting on an airplane. You know, if we wanted to live in a world where risk was zero, where nobody would ever die, where the risk of somebody ever dying was zero, we would never get into a car and drive on the highway. So at some point, you know, the question becomes not only what is the risk of transmitting COVID-19 if you're not wearing a mask, but also what is the risk that people will be hospitalized or seriously ill or die from it? Because if we're just talking about transmission and people getting it, at some point when a large portion of the population is vaccinated, you know, merely transmitting it isn't particularly relevant. The question is whether people are being hospitalized and dying in large numbers.
All right, so I want to go to the phones here. 1-800-423-8255. We're already into a lively conversation. We want you to be a part of it. How are you reacting to the changes in the outdoor mask mandate? What are your personal practices? What do you want to see change next? All of it is on the table. We've got Dave on the line from West Roxbury. Dave, go ahead.
Hi. Well, first off, I'm a fully vaccinated Moderna person, so that's how I'm speaking. But I was watching the president the other night and the 200 people in the House of Chambers, and they're all in masks. I'm thinking, some vaccine we got. We can't even get 200 people in the room spread out, all fully vaccinated, all having tested, getting their temperature taken, I'm sure, all the time. And they can't even sit in a room to listen to the president speak without a mask on. We're close to having no mask. We need to decide what we need to do.
Thanks for that, Dave. So I'm going to pull Michael, the piece of that I really zeroed in on what Dave just said was some vaccine we have, with the implication being if people are vaccinated from this signaling standpoint, does it signal vaccine hesitancy or does it signal extra care and safe practices to have a group of people that we think, we don't know, but we think are fully vaccinated and socially distanced inside some place like, you know, the joint session room, still wearing masks?
Yeah, I think it's important for your caller to think about a few things. One is I'm not certain, and Jennifer may know this, but not every member may have been vaccinated. Some people may have chosen not to be vaccinated. Another factor is it's 94-95% effective if you're Pfizer or Moderna or depending on J&J, right? So even less. So the reality is there's still risk. And I think what the members of Congress were trying to, back to your original question, to signal to the rest of America is we're not fully past this pandemic. It's not about the, you know, whether we have trust in the vaccines. We know that there's a limitation to the vaccines we have. It's about saying to Americans, let's be cautious. I end that point on this, Jennifer. There are places and pockets of communities in this country where people have still not taken the vaccine. They're hesitant, particularly in communities of color. and immigrant communities. So there's still a major risk, a high risk to certain communities. And I think they're trying to signal to people, wear a mask, particularly when you're in circumstances that you could put other people at risk, whether you've been vaccinated or not.
Jennifer, jump in.
I think the problem is that it's sending the exact opposite and wrong message to people who are hesitant to take the vaccine. What it's telling them is that if you do take the vaccine, you will not be able to, will still not be able to go back to normal. You will still have to mask. You will still have to socially distance. And by telling people that, you are encouraging this feeling of, well, why should I bother? Maybe, you know, to some people who are vaccine hesitant, they then say that the risk of the vaccine does you know, is too high for them. Now, I don't agree with that. I think everybody should get vaccinated. But I think that by this obsessive masking, I mean, I think of the picture of President Biden on the phone with all the world leaders on a Zoom call, and they were on this call from their desks, nobody around them. Every world leader was maskless except President Biden. I mean, it just looks silly. And the message he's sending is don't get vaccinated because you won't be able to get back to normal. You know, I'm with Governor DeSantis on this and Ted Cruz. If you're vaccinated, act like it.
I would just disagree with Jennifer. Yeah, just a little bit. I have to remind people all the time, this is a pandemic. So I think people tend to get frustrated with policymakers about, or Fauci or local scientists and researchers around this. Like it's their fault that they have a wear a mask. We're in the middle of a pandemic. And I just to level set where we are, we're talking about 145. Jennifer, just let me finish the point, please. 145 plus million people infected across the world. We're talking over 3 million deaths. The size of some cities in the U.S. have died. 566,000 deaths, maybe across the United States, 32 million cases. I just want us to take this seriously. There is not going to be an absolute science because we're figuring this out. And if people want to heighten their consciousness or their cautiousness by wearing a mask, I have no problem with you sitting 6 feet from people and you still wearing a mask at the restaurant until your food comes. It is just smart. I would defer to people to use their own personal choice. But what I'm saying is I want to model that when and wherever I can to say, you know what, for some communities, this is still going to be a disease carrying out for years to come, months, if not years to come. And wearing a mask and social distancing may save someone's life.
Listeners, what do you think? Join this conversation. The conversation we're having back and forth here is the conversation we're having in the country. Where do you stand on it? 800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Jennifer, I think you had some more you wanted to add there.
Oh, no. I mean, you know, look, if somebody wants to wear a mask and take that extra precaution, I'm all for that. You know, and I have no judgment there. I do think our leaders, though, when they do silly things like wear masks on a Zoom call.
Why is that silly, though?
President of the United States, he's not within 6 feet of anybody.
He's an individual with the same right as the one you said earlier. He can make that personal choice himself.
Not wearing a mask. Angela Merkel's not wearing a mask. None of these people. Putin's not wearing a mask. Nobody's wearing a mask except Biden. I don't understand.
Individual choice. We're not under Trump anymore. Yeah, you have to do the pomp and circumstance to make people think that you're stronger than them. You can make an individual choice.
Of course, it's individual choice, but he wasn't wearing it for individual choice. He was wearing.
How do you know that?
Let me finish.
No, wait, Michael, let her finish now. Go ahead, Jennifer.
He's wearing it, as he said, and as his press secretary said, to send a message, to signal that this is what people should do. And my point is that the message that the President of the United States is sending in that particular situation is that even once you're vaccinated, and even if you're not near another human being, you're going to have to keep masking. That message discourages people from getting the vaccine, because if they can't go back to normal, they don't see a point.
If you don't get the vaccine because that discourages you, then you already have a problem with getting a vaccine. That's an excuse. The reality is you need to get a vaccine once you determine that it's efficacious and it's safe for you to take it, and it will more likely save your life than whether Biden wears a mask or not. Should not be a deciding factor. I know we want to reopen and people want to get back to life as normal, but we're not in that normal anymore. We're entering a new normal where people will make choices that are right for them whether it's right for them for their own safety or it's right for them because they want to model the behavior that might save someone else's life. The reality
okay,
is
I'm gonna
get
a call.
Too much into splitting hairs on this stuff.
I'm going to get a call in here. 800-423-8255. Brian's on the line in Yarmouthport. Brian, go ahead.
Hi. I just want to remind everybody that we still haven't achieved the percentage of vaccines that we need to get anywhere near herd immunity. And also remind people that this is a global pandemic and that this pandemic is going to continue on till everybody in the world is vaccinated. It's not just a United States thing.
Okay, thanks Absolutely. For that. Jennifer, response to Brian there.
Well, I think part of the problem with the masking, social distancing, and lockdown policies, it's not that people don't agree with them or don't want to abide by them in good faith. It's the amount of hypocrisy they see in them. So, for example, when I go to an airport and I see the airlines packing them in like cattle, but I'm told that, you know, my kids can't go to school and sit 3 feet apart from somebody else. It does make me wonder what's going on here. And I think that's what people have had enough of. People have had enough of the hypocrisy. Kids can't go to school because they can't, you know, they have to be 6 feet apart. Well, you know, not anymore. They're all back now, at least in my district. But, you know, it doesn't make sense to people. That you're forcing people to wear masks and stay 6 feet apart in certain circumstances, but when money's involved, they're willing to pack them in.
So I do want to go to the phones again, but Michael, let me give you a chance. What about that? I am thinking about the fact, Michael, for example, that the last of the airlines are going to start filling that middle seat again, starting May 1st, starting tomorrow.
At the last two places.
No, wait. I want to give Michael a chance here.
Yeah, so one is your caller was absolutely right. We have not achieved herd immunity globally. In fact, some countries, Africa and other countries, are not getting the vaccines they need. We know that we could see variants that may even be resistant to the vaccinations we've received. And we may be likely looking at booster shots by the fall and an annual, because this is becoming endemic, an annual COVID shot. So, I mean, we can rush to get past this all we want. But the science and disease does not work like that. Public health doesn't work like that.
Okay, so I'm going to take one more call to take us out. We're going to go to a break. Listeners, we're going to keep this up when we come back from the break. I do want to talk a little bit more about vaccinations and some other pieces of the reopening. So let's pick up Emma here in Braintree. And Emma, I think you're in your car. Is that right?
Yes, I am. I just want to say that I'm a visiting nurse. So my goal when I go into someone's house is I need to educate them on different disease processes as well as COVID-19. And what I find is because when I go in someone's house, people that have been vaccinated, they feel as though they don't have to wear a mask. And I have to educate them and instruct them and let them know that even though they are vaccinated, they still can contract the virus as well as giving the virus to someone else. So I think that it does not signal or give the wrong message for you to wear a mask because it will remind others to do the same practices. That way we don't continue to keep spreading this virus.
Okay, Emma, thanks for that call. Actually, let's just pick up one more because, boy, they are just, flying in. Kathleen in Centerville. Kathleen, go ahead.
Hi, I'm just defending President Biden and the congressional members for wearing masks. I'm 74. I'm a physician, retired. And I think that people in that particular group in Congress, if I were Biden, I sure as heck would have worn a mask also. Many of those people do not believe, or at least they say they don't believe, in the efficacy of masks. In that particular group, I definitely wear a mask. I was sympathetic, and I thought it was fine.
Okay, and I do want to clarify that the CDC does say that the evidence suggests that fully vaccinated people do not transmit COVID-19. That's to the previous call. And again, we are talking about margins of risk calculus, signaling, sense of personal safety, et cetera. This is a thumping good conversation. We're going to keep it up. Jennifer Braceras, Michael Curry, stay with us. Listeners, the number is 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I am Tiziana Dearing. We're going to go to a break and then come back with more of Radio Boston's Week in Review. still with us, our panelists, Michael Curry of the Massachusetts League of Community Health Centers and Jennifer Braceras, director of the Independent Women's Law Center. We have been having a lively conversation that started with masks, signaling, risk calculus, science. We're going to spend a little more time in this section talking about reopening, vaccinations, return to normal, quote unquote, what's happening for businesses, how Massachusetts compares to the reopening plans of states around us. We want to include you in that conversation. The number is 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And since we have so many calls, I'm going to start right off with a couple. We've got Betsy on the line in Swampscott. Betsy, go ahead.
Hi, I'm an OBGYN, and I wear a mask not just because of myself and my health as an asthmatic, but also because no vaccine is 100% perfect. And with the variants out there, I am concerned. And I also do this because I need to protect my patients and their children and the other people at the hospital. So when I deliver babies and I have to wear a mask, even though I'm vaccinated, I do so as a matter of protection of the staff and the people I care about.
Thank you, Betsy. I appreciate that. 800-423-8255. Lily is on the line from Acton. Lily, go ahead.
Yeah, hi. I'd just like to say that the big problem with COVID is the deaths. You know, we see the flu, and that's not causing deaths. So with this vaccine, the big thing is to eliminate that huge risk factor. So with our vaccine, we're seeing that they are preventing deaths, but people are still able to contract COVID. You're still able to carry it. So wearing a mask is still incredibly important to help everyone around us and to ultimately limit the spread. So, yes, wear your mask, please.
Thank you. Thank you, Lily. And as I prepare to return to Michael and Jennifer, I'm going to add a little sound to this and steer our conversation a bit. Here is Governor Baker this week talking about concerns among cases. Now, bear with me for a second. Cases among younger Massachusetts residents. We know death rates are different, but he is talking about infection and spread. Here's the governor.
One of the things I don't want young people or younger people to walk away believing is that, you know, this isn't about them. This isn't going to affect them. These new variants are clearly more troubling for younger people than some of the earlier strains of COVID.
So we have this conversation against the backdrop of what we've known for the last year, quote unquote known. I mean, our knowledge is evolving all the time. But we also have a changing dynamic happening right this minute, Michael Curry. And how are we, and are we keeping up in our conversations and our mental framing with these variants, how they're affecting, who they're spreading to, et cetera?
Yeah, you know, so interesting. I think there's a post-op we could do when we get further along from this pandemic. And it's, you know, which mask should you wear? N95, a KN95, a surgical mask, or as some of us were told early on, just put a scarf over your face. And I tend to think that you should apply common sense in this stuff from the beginning. You don't have to be an epidemiologist or a physician to know what will keep you from getting a disease is probably the mask with the most protection. The same has been true throughout this pandemic. We need to use common sense. And common sense says, even if the CDC says, and I know this is evolving, whether you can have a vaccine and still contract, spread the disease, why not be cautious, right? We're still learning more. There's still research happening right now. It does not suffer us anything to exercise some caution in the next few months until we get more data, until we know that we're saving more lives. It is selfish, quite frankly, and I hate to be that blunt with it. It's selfish what I hear often across the country where people worried about livelihoods over lives and their comfort and their entertainment over trying to eliminate this disease as much as we can, or at least curtail the deaths.
So I want to sharpen on this livelihood versus lives, which is a tension we have talked about here on air, here in the Commonwealth, nationally, really since the shutdowns of last March. So bear with me for a second. WBUR News spoke with Stephen Clark of the Massachusetts Restaurants Association as the governor announced some additional loosening of restrictions and the plan to full lifting of business restrictions by August 1st. Now, they have said that the governor's reopening is, quote, the light at the end of a very dark tunnel, end quote, but also that the hospitality industry has already had its hands tied by the governor's many restrictions. Here is Stephen Clark.
We're the industry of saying yes. And I think a lot of times the general public is coming out and saying, hey, how come we can't do this? How come I can't have a party of eight for Mother's Day? And there's definitely some enforcement fatigue in our industry.
And to Jennifer Braceras, to some extent, you hear Stephen there echoing what Michael is expressing frustration with, which is people wanting to have fun, wanting to have the hospitality industry cater to them, wanting to return to old activities while we've got a global pandemic still raging. And yet that fatigue is also real. So let me just give you that whole bundle to react to.
Well, first of all, you know, the livelihood versus lives dichotomy is a false dichotomy, because livelihood for some people is their lives. And some people, you know, can't survive without their livelihood. Not everybody is a white collar worker who can zoom in to WBUR from their home. So, you know, I don't think it's that simple. We're also talking about mental health. We've seen an extreme rise in depression, anxiety, and all sorts of mental health disorders during the early lockdowns. And I would also add that we're talking about the education of a whole generation of children. Many, you know, many, the ones who are, you've heard me say this before, Tiziana, the ones who are most adversely impacted by this are the ones who were disadvantaged to begin with. And they're the ones who are going to have the most trouble catching up. So it is not just a simple livelihood versus lives scenario. This isn't about money. This is about risk analysis, just as it is when you get into a car. And of course, there are situations where we need to continue to be cautious, even if we're vaccinated, or even if, you know, the rates are, the death rates have gone down dramatically. Yes, there are situations, but there is no need for outdoor masking. There never was when you're by yourself with your dog taking a walk. And so some of this is just silly. And,
Let's break Michael in here. And I'm going to come to Michael. And Michael, I'm going to have you make a point. And then I just want to note, they're calling so much that our lines are full. They're calling the front desk. They're calling newscast. So the listeners want to get in on this, too. Michael, you're up.
I know my friend Jennifer did not direct this at me, but I'm just going to say it anyway. I'm a civil rights activist, and I understand that there are very much people who can't phone into WBUR and work from home, who are being disadvantaged with the achievement gaps because they have to do remote learning, and we weren't prepared to do remote learning, or that we don't have broadband and Wi-Fi, and they can't get telehealth access like we needed to, or they still got to show up to run the train or be at the grocery store. So let's make this, that false dichotomy she talked about is not true. We do need to make sure that our economy is moving. But if we do that and lose lives, what do we benefit from that grocery store worker who dies? Because we want to make sure that we're opening up so they can go to work. We need to be able to walk and chew gum at the same time. That's what the stimulus packages is for. That's what these checks in the households are for. That's what PPP is for, to keep these businesses going while we figure out the science and figure out how to save lives. We can do both. But the reality is they don't, let me finish the point, Jennifer. But we do this thing as if we ignore the disease. The number one priority for us as a country right now and as a world is to deal with this pandemic. Then we can also, while we're doing that, figure out how to keep our economy afloat. But the number one priority is to make sure that I don't lose my grandmother, my mother, my sons, and quite frankly, lose my own life while we're trying to figure out how to keep a store open or a club going.
Yeah.
So I'm going to break. No, I'm going to break in on both of you now. I'm going to get some caller voices in here because there are so many callers who also want a part of this conversation. Karen in Lexington. Karen, go ahead.
Yeah. Hi. Thank you so much. I am. I was asked to be brief, and that's not anything that I specialize in, especially when I feel passionate about something. But
I know, Karen, but
point.
We do need you to be. Thanks.
Okay, here goes. Why can't we all just make this an opportunity to express the need to come together and wear a mask to just show that you care about not only yourself, but everyone else? I mean, it could be that simple, because what is the problem with wearing a mask? I mean, why is that so hard?
Let's take it back from you there. Karen, good job keeping it tight. That was a good point, and thank you for calling in. We've got Jonathan on the line from Cambridge. I'm going to add your voice, too. Jonathan, go ahead.
Hi. I mean, one thing that keeps coming up in all these discussions is so much emotion and so much feeling. And I think when we look to the science, we can see very clearly you don't need masks outside. Get a vaccine. That's really great protection. And I think it's okay to say that some people are just uncomfortable and they're making decisions based on their feeling. But public policy can't be based on feeling. And I think that that's something that is really hampering the reopening in a lot of places. Thank you.
Thank you, Jonathan. One more call here. Ruth and I admit I'm not sure remembering if it's Rowley or it's Rowley. That's right. Ruth and Rowley. Go ahead.
Hi. I just want to say that I think what is missing in this conversation is that we had a pandemic in 1918 that lasted 3 years. And there are various strains to this virus. And I think it's very short-sighted that people don't think about the collective good, not just of the United States, but of the world. And until this pandemic is under control, we all have a responsibility to protect not only ourselves, but each other. And I couldn't agree more with Michael's comments. I am proud to be a mask wearer, and I continue to wear it, even though I'm fully vaccinated, and I will until there's safety for all. Thank you very
Ruth,
much.
Ruth, thanks for that call. Okay, Jennifer, you kind of I cut Jennifer off before the caller, so Michael, I'm going to pop to Jennifer, then back to you, and then, folks, probably to a break. Jennifer, go ahead.
Well, I think what's fascinating about this is I sort of feel like I'm living through, you know, an episode of Groundhog Day with Bill Murray. I mean, this is the same conversation that we had a year ago on the show that we've all been having for the past year. And it's almost as if we haven't taken into account the fact that we have a vaccine, that we have treatments now that obviously aren't perfect, but that are better, that we know a lot more about this disease than we did when it first came out. I mean, things have changed dramatically since last year. And yet this entire conversation is premised, we're acting as though nothing is different. And all of the things that Michael is saying are things that, you know, 13, 12 months ago, I probably would have agreed with. But we have a vaccine now. Almost everyone can have access to it now. People should get it. You're right, we're not at herd immunity yet, but we're getting there. And we, you know, let's get there as fast as we can and be done with it. You're never going to eliminate the risk of COVID. Yes, there will be variants. Yes, you know, it's a global pandemic and it will keep coming back and we'll keep needing boosters and we'll keep needing to readjust at the margins. But we cannot live with masks and in lockdowns and crippling our economy and our educational system for 3 years. That's not tenable.
So Michael, I'm going to turn to you. I just want everyone, this is so lively. I want everyone to know what's going on. Michael, I'm coming to you. Then we're going to take a couple callers and go to break, and then we're going to take on a new subject. So last word on this for you, Michael.
I so appreciate your caller, the last caller, because the past is prologue. 5 million people plus died in 1918 from the Spanish flu. What people probably don't know is that the disease came in the spring of 1918. There was some degree of herd immunity. By the time it came back in the fall, more deadly, many more people died. So the reality is there's so much uncertainty with this disease that we just do not know yet. And what I think I hear from Jennifer that concerns me, because she's not an epidemiologist, she's not a scientist, she's not a doctor, is that we want to defer to the people who actually study this, who know this, and who still have uncertainties. I sat on the governor's COVID-19 vaccine working group with some really smart people, including our new head of the CDC. And what I could tell you is there was not always agreement among the researchers, the doctors, the epidemiologists. There was debate. So what we're saying is that there's still uncertainty. Let's just have an abundance of caution as we go forward. And let's stop acting like we know what we're talking about when, in fact, the science is telling us that we don't. There's still disagreement in the science community right now on all of these issues.
The CDC, and this is science, has been extremely clear. 0.008% of people who get vaccinated will contract the virus. Okay? That is an infinitesimal amount. It is riskier to get in a car and drive to the supermarket.
All right. So this has been a lively conversation, and I've appreciated both of you in it. I feel like you're mirroring much of where we are as a public. I'm going to get a couple more caller voices in because there have just been so many. Then we're going to go to a break. And when we come back, I do want to start having a conversation about some looking forward issues as well. And I do want to note 5,800 fully vaccinated people, or 0.008%, have contracted COVID, according to the CDC, just underscoring that data, because our producers are fact-checking like crazy while we talk here. Okay, Catherine in Waltham. Catherine, go ahead.
Yes, hi. Thanks for taking my call. I am a cashier at a grocery store in Newton, and I just want to touch on some of the lives versus livelihood points made earlier. I really appreciated Michael's point about that there's so much we still don't know about vaccines, about the virus, about the variants. As a cashier, I come across people who, quite frankly, are pretty arrogant. They will stand really close to me because they want to watch the prices on the screen or something like that. And they will say, oh, I'm fully vaccinated. And I really would just want them to follow the store's guidelines. I want them to stand 6 feet away from me until I say, hey, you can come up and pay now. Because there's just so much we don't know. And a little bit of humility really wouldn't hurt any of us. So
Catherine, thank you. And actually, I think that's the call to go to the break on. Lots of callers we're not going to get to on this, but we're glad you called in. You know we're going to continue these conversations. You are listening to Radio Boston's Week in Review. Michael Curry, Jennifer Bracera, stick with us. When we come back, we are going to talk about the gloves off in Washington and the progressive agenda that Joe Biden laid out, and specifically how it will affect us here in Massachusetts. This is Radio Boston's Week in Review. Still with us, our panelists this week, Jennifer Braceras, director of the Independent Women's Law Center, and Michael Curry of the Massachusetts League of Community Health Centers. And you, the number to join our conversation is 800-423-8255. Our theme this week was that the masks were coming off and the gloves were coming off. We've certainly had a lively masks coming off conversation. So let's just give a couple minutes now to the fact that the gloves came off in Washington as President Joe Biden in his 100-day address put out a very progressive agenda. Here is Senator Ed Markey talking to me about that on our show yesterday.
It was a Massachusetts-directed speech. He talked about education. He talked about healthcare. He talked about innovation. He talked about climate change. We're not just the Bay State. We're the brain state. And we believe in science, and we believe in the need to have to deal with the consequences of the climate crisis. And then the answer is creating millions of new jobs.
So focusing like a laser beam on how the agenda we heard in that speech affects and comes home to Massachusetts. Jennifer Braceras, was it a Massachusetts-directed speech?
Well, in the sense that Massachusetts is a very progressive state, yes. I think he laid out a progressive agenda. It was not necessarily a bipartisan agenda. He campaigned as somebody who would bring us together. And in some ways, in terms of tone, I think he has. And I credit him for that. But in terms of policy, he is governing from the far left, particularly through his aggressive use of executive orders to accomplish things that he wouldn't be able to get through the Congress. And, you know, passing bills without a single Republican vote is not a way to bring people together or you know, try to reach the middle. So I'm quite sure that the midterm elections will be a big disappointment to the Democrats because he isn't governing from the middle and he has an opportunity to.
Michael.
Yeah, you know, so one, credit to Senator Markey, who allowed me to be with him for the
president's speech. That's right. You were his virtual guest.
Yes, I was his virtual guest, and we had a great conversation leading up to Biden's speech. So interesting to me. I think, you know, people on the right who are arguing that his speech was divisive, that it wasn't about bringing the country together. Where were they at last 4 years? I'm like, Tim Scott, who gave the rebuttal to the speech, said, we want to stop talking about race and bring the country together. And I'm like, where was this man at for the Trump presidency? The reality is he was talking about families. He was talking about investments. That's not Republican families. That's not Democrat families. That's not independent families. That's putting resources into the hands of Americans so that they can thrive and succeed. We're talking about infrastructure. We all drive on those roads, those bridges, those train rail systems that are deteriorating. We're talking about policies that could help all Americans. But here's the play, right? All the world's a stage. There is no Republican that's going to support anything that Biden does for the same reason they didn't support Obama, because it's arguing the ends to win. And unfortunately, that's where we are as a country. And it forces us into this dynamic where if you have control, then you try to get through as much as you can before you lose control. That's real.
That's actually not true, Michael. I mean, the Republicans, for example, came forward with their own infrastructure plan that they're happy to work with. The president acknowledged that the other night. They're happy to work with them to try to find common ground. The big difference being that the Republican bill actually focuses on infrastructure, transportation, water systems, broadband, whereas the president's plan includes all sorts of things like childcare and universal preschool and in-home care for people with disabilities. Now, those might be things that you support. I'm not weighing in on them one way or the other, but they are not infrastructure, and they are not things that are likely to get through this Congress, particularly to the tune of trillions of dollars.
And just so you just get the play, just the playbook. If you think that the Trump administration or Republicans didn't attach other things with their proposals that weren't directly aligned with what the issue was before Congress, then you didn't pay attention for the last 4 years. So it was about building walls. But my point is that's the playbook. You've been doing this a long time, Jennifer. There's always attachments to things because you're trying to make it a big omnibus bill to get really progressive or conservative things done. Let's not act like that's just under the Biden administration.
Okay, I'm gonna break in for a second here on this.
I don't like them from either party. I'm completely bipartisan on my opposition to that tactic.
Okay, so tactic stipulated, opposition to tactic stipulated. I actually want to bring in this guy. I love the two of you together.
And
this
I love
conversation.
Jennifer too, so.
we had Catherine Clark on the show a couple of weeks ago, and I asked her the question about this definition of infrastructure. And was this infrastructure bill changing the definition of infrastructure? And her answer was yes. Yes, it is, and it's important too, because what we rely on to function changes over time. So let's step out of the bill, let's step out of the partisanship, and let me ask the two of you. Oh, and by the way, Congresswoman Clark also said, we have changed the definition of infrastructure a number of times in the past. Is it time to redefine what infrastructure is? And could we find that as a way to find some common ground? I'm going to go Jennifer and then Michael. Jennifer.
Well, look, there's a Republican proposal on the table. There's a Democratic proposal on the table. And I think if both sides are willing to talk, yes, we can find common ground. I don't think that the Republican leaders are going to be fixated on what you call infrastructure, but they are going to try to cabinet and keep it as close to the original definition as possible. Are they going to be willing to budge on both on definition and dollars? Of course they are. That's what negotiations are all about.
Michael, what about you? The idea that it's time to redefine what infrastructure is.
Yeah, I'm going to stretch here to say a Latin phrase, ad reductio ad absurdum, right? Reduce something to absurd. And I would say, just like if you and I, Jennifer, went to eat at a meal, right, and we had to choose the same meal and eat off the same plate, we might have to negotiate on what a meal is, right? Is it a vegetable? Is it whatever it is? And that's how our political system works. People have to sit down and hash out the details. Infrastructure is not what it was before as it is today. It's online. It's how do you regulate and control what people are getting through online systems. It's cybersecurity. It could be roads and bridges and train systems, or it could be broadband. And how do you make sure that people have access all this technology that we've been quantum leaped into? So we can't stay in place. We have to be willing to sort of evolve with a growing definition of what infrastructure is. But this is really not about that. This is about not bending into a Biden administration. It's simply what it is, because I can guarantee there are Republicans who want to invest in some of these same things. But you want to win back the midterm. Win back the midterms when you can't let Biden have any major victories in the first few years of his presidency.
I don't think that's Michael. True. I think the Republicans have come in good faith on this one. I mean, I don't want to keep talking
on this one being infrastructure, Jennifer.
Yes, and I don't want to keep talking about the Trump administration, but even President Trump wanted to do an infrastructure bill. I do think that this is not a divisive issue. when it comes to partisan politics. I think if you stick to water systems, broadband, you know, transportation, roads, bridges, internet access, I think you'll be able to have wide agreement.
Okay, so I'm going to take a caller here to get us out of this conversation and into our hubbubs. Hannah is on the line from Worcester. Hannah, go ahead.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I just wanted to say, I think, you know, whether it means expanding the idea of infrastructure or not, I think, you know, in the pandemic or the first part of this conversation really highlights this point is that, you know, this is not a red or a blue issue. This is an American issue, the bills that we pass, how we deal with COVID, whether we wear our masks. And I think this is an opportunity for people to start looking out for their fellow Americans, red, blue, whatever. And I think, I really hope that our leaders in Congress really start looking at this as well, because I think a lot of us are really sick of playing this 4-8 year back and forth where nobody wants to compromise and look out for our fellow Americans rather than our red or our blue Americans.
Hannah, thanks for that call. And every once in a while, we give our callers the last word. I did on that one. Thanks for that call, Hannah. So, lively conversation. And before we go, let's take a minute, take a deep breath, and turn to our hubbubs, which are those, see, I can't even say it, I'm so discombobulated, those brief local stories or events that caught our attention this week. Michael, did you bring us a hubbub?
Yeah, I think I have a great one. Really, in this pandemic, it's really impacted us all, really had us sheltering in place and not able to interact with loved ones, particularly our seniors. Something happened in Massachusetts, which was pretty phenomenal. It was in the Boston Globe, the giant happy birthday letters that were passed around Arlington for months. So basically, it was these huge letters for happy birthday that one family put in place for a family member. And now it's traveling throughout Arlington. I just think that's inspiring. People who are, as they're getting back to some degree of normalcy, are sharing this happy birthday poster board that is now traveling throughout Arlington. It's just a great sign about community in the midst of a pandemic.
It also makes me think of the conversations about the sharing economy that we had at the beginning of the pandemic and how that might emerge. That's great. Jennifer, how about you?
Yeah, I love that story. Mine is sort of the opposite. It's the opposite of community building. If you want to get away from your community and completely socially distance and go off the grid, you can buy a house that is the only house on a single island off of Rhode Island. It just went on the market, I guess, and there's a story in the Boston Globe about it. You can buy it for $399,000. I think you won't have electricity, but you can go completely disconnect from society and avoid the coronavirus.
God, that is the perfect yin and yang, right? You can either share birthday letters in celebration, or you can remove yourself to an island, all of which is available right now. Okay, so my hubbub I'm going to use to bid a fond farewell to a friend of the show, Stephanie Murray, who is Politico's Massachusetts Playbook author. She's leaving her role today after gracing our inboxes with sharp reporting, curation, which she's been a joy, and she's been on the show several times. She investigated ball pits as kind of a last hurrah after ball pits were explicitly named as something that could reopen on August 1st. And so she decided to go find out if there's some secret ball pit lobby. She talked to Congress people, ball pit businesses. One state legislator apparently texted her, quote, "I can assure you I have not heard from the ball pit people," end quote. But somehow they made it to the top level listing. And another thought that the ball pit thing must have been a typo. So Stephanie's conclusion, if there is something lobbying for the ball pit industry, someone, they are doing a pretty good job of keeping it private. Stephanie, we have enjoyed you. We will miss you. Bon voyage, and thanks for bringing us the ball pit story. Okay, Michael Curry, President and CEO of the Massachusetts Legal Community Health Centers, Jennifer Braceras of the Independent Women's Law Center, thanks to both of you.
Thank you. Tiziana, I'm treating Jennifer to dinner, and she's wearing a mask.
Woohoo!
All right, let's get them those terms.
Hey, have a good weekend, everyone. That's our show for today. Join us again Monday for more Radio Boston.